We're going to spend the next two classes on a Lojong text called The Wheel of Knives. The Tibetan is Tsunsha Korlo. So say Tsunsha.
Tsunsha.
Korlo.
Korlo.
Tsunsha Korlo.
Tsunsha Korlo.
Korlo.
Tsunsha Korlo.
Tsunsha Korlo.
Yeah. Tsunsha means weapon, and it can be any kind of a weapon. You know, a gun can be a tsunsha, but a sword or a knife or whatever. And korlo means circle or wheel. So it's the wheel of knives. And the FPMT has been translated as the wheel of sharp weapons. But Geshe-la feels that wheel of knives is better because the wheel is in fact just, well, a wheel of knives, and that's it. It isn't any other kind of weapon. This wheel is described in a tantra. There's not many references to it in scripture at all. Well, before I tell you what it is, the text was written by Dharma Rakshita, who was an Indian author. We don't know his dates. We do know that he was a master of Abhidharma teachings, lower school teachings. And he presented this text to Lord Atisha before Lord Atisha went to Tibet. So, given the fact that he did that, that he presented the text to Lord Atisha, he lived somewhere in late 800s to early 900s. Well, mid 900s. No, that couldn't be. Lord Atisha was born in 982. Yeah, so he lived in the 900s. Maybe a little bit into the 1000s, too. So the Wheel of Knives is described, it's in a tantra, and there's a, as soon as I can find it, I'm working from three sets of notes here. This description is given by Mulchu Dharma Bhadra. He's an important person in our lineage. And this text is on the creation stage for a secret teaching known as the Frightener. His other name is Bhairava and also Yamantaka. Since you're all going to be Yamantaka someday, I can read you this paragraph from the text. Oh, Yamantaka, by the way, has lots of arms. And one of his hands holds a wheel of knives. So here's the description. Here, a wheel of knives is described as a wheel made of iron, having many spokes made of knives sharpened on both sides of the blades, without any rim around the outside of the wheel. At the center or hub of the wheel is a space that allows you to put your fingers so you can throw the wheel at someone. So it is sort of a big ninja star, or perhaps we can think of it as a razor-tipped boomerang, something like that. Now, razor-tipped boomerang isn't in the text. It's just kind of a metaphor we have of what this thing might be like. When you get the Yamantaka empowerment, you'll have a picture of Bhairava. A Yamantaka, and you'll be able to find this wheel, but it isn't very distinct since he's holding many, 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 many more weapons in all of his hands. But anyway, the wheel is thrown, and what it does, when you throw it, it goes and slices somebody and comes back and you can grab it. So it's like a boomerang in that sense. So this Lojong text is talking about how our karma always comes back and gets us in the end, and we have to understand that. There's a story in the Jataka tales of a young man who lives with his parents in a seaside village. His father's a fisherman, and one day his father is killed at sea. And later on, when the young man's in his late teens, he wants to go to sea too. But his mother says no. You know, she's afraid that he's going to die like his father did. So she doesn't want him to go to sea. A year or so later, his friends are going on a journey by sea, and he asked his mother's permission to go with them. And she says no, you know, please stay. And he's really angry, you know, but he says, okay, I'll stay. A year later or so, his last friends are going on a voyage, and he wants to go. And again, she says, no, please stay, you know. And again, he's angry. And he decides to go anyway. As he's leaving, she tries to block the door. And he accidentally hits her on the head as he's trying to get out. So he gets on the boat, and he goes to sea. They travel around for a while. And then the boat gets shipwrecked on a desert isle. You know, he's the only one who survives. And he crawls ashore. And he finds nothing there. It's only a forest. So he wanders around in the forest for a while. And he's dying of thirst. He falls down unconscious. And after a while, he wakes up. And there above him are three beautiful young women. And they're covered with jewels, and they're dressed nicely, you know, and they look wonderful. And they tell him, you know, come to our castle with us. So he goes with them, and he lives in bliss in the castle with them for a while. One day he goes out to walk around the forest, and he gets lost. He runs out of food and water, and he falls unconscious again. When he wakes up, there are six young women, and they say, come with us, and we will take care of you. And he says, great. So they pick him up, and they lead him into the castle, and he lives there in luxury for years. Then again, he goes out into the forest, and he gets lost. He comes on this fort with a moat around it. And there's a bridge going across the moat. So he goes up to the gate, and he pushes it open. And it creaks. You know, it's very old and not used recently. There's nobody around, and it's dark and creepy, you know, kind of like in a horror movie. And the gate slams behind him. And he looks up, and way above him, a door opens, and this guy steps out. And there's a wheel spinning around his head. And there are knives sticking out of the wheel. They're sharpened on both sides. And the wheel is slicing his head. And he's in terrible pain. And the young man asks, what's happening? What is that thing there? And so the man tells this young man the story. He said, when I was young, I lived by the sea. I lived with my mother. My father went to sea. He died. My friends came to me and tried to talk me into going to sea. I wanted to go, and I asked my mother, and she said no. I listened to her the first time, and I listened to her the second time. And the third time, I decided not to follow her wishes, and I rushed out the door and accidentally hit her on the head. I ran down to the sea and got on a ship, and we went to this desert island. We got shipwrecked, and I crawled up on the beach. Then I went unconscious, and then I woke up to all these beautiful damsels. Later, I went unconscious again. So by this time, you know, the young man's beginning to shake, and he yells, you know, what is this wheel? And the man said, this is the karma that happened to me. Because I listened to my mother the first time, I met these three beautiful young women. Because I listened to my mother the second time, I met six beautiful young women. The third time I didn't listen to my mother, and because of that, I have this thing chopping my head. I came to this fort, and I heard this story from another guy standing where I am now. And this wheel came down from off his head and came down the stairs to my head. And I have been like this since then. So now the young man is really trembling, you know, and he closes his eyes. He gets ready for the wheel to come to his head. And he thinks, no, let the wheel come to my head. Let it come to me from that other guy. So at that moment, you know, he gets bodhicitta, wanting to take on the pain of this other guy. So he closes his eyes and gets ready for the pain of the wheel of knives. And nothing happens. He opens his eyes, and the fort's gone, you know, and he's in this beautiful castle. You know, so this is the real Tsensha Korlo. It's the real wheel of knives. This is one of the few references to a wheel of knives in all the scriptures. And it's found in the Kangyur collection of Buddhist texts because it's in the Jataka tales, which are tales, stories that Lord Buddha told about his previous lives. And then there's the reference that I just gave you from Tantra, from the from Yamantaka. So we have to get used to the idea that the wheel of knives is a razor, like a razor-tipped boomerang. When you do something bad, what you do is you throw this boomerang out, and eventually it comes back to slice you up. When somebody yells at you in the office, you know, you look around to see who did this to you, not realizing that you threw this boomerang much earlier, and now it's returned to you with somebody yelling at you. So whenever something bad happens to us, we look around to see who did it, you know, forgetting about when we hurt somebody else much earlier, you know, that we threw that boomerang out, and now it's returned to us. So this text talks about things that happened to us, you know, and then goes on to describe what we did when we threw the boomerang out and what we must do, or perhaps not do, from now on in order to not keep throwing boomerangs out. We're constantly throwing wheels of knives all day long, you know, 4, 5, 6 times an hour maybe. You know, even something like taking the last piece of cake from the plate at the office is throwing out a wheel of knives. So you're going to get kind of a combination of lineages in this teaching. I first received the teaching from Kyabche Tupten Zopa Rinpoche in 1994. And in 1998, I received a 7-day commentary on this text from Chodron Rinpoche in Italy. It was during Christmas break. And I've received it 3 times from Geshe Michael Roach. The first time was in Dublin, Ireland, over a weekend. The next weekend was in Galway, Ireland. And then I got it once from him in California as well. So before we talk about the text, we're going to cover some basics of karma. Now, you've heard this hundreds of times before, and you're going to hear it again. Karma means, Sanskrit word, means action. And it implies the result that comes from an action. So karma is both the creating of what we call a karmic seed and the ripening of that seed. When you plant a seed of corn, for example, you will eventually harvest an ear of corn. When you step on a bug and crush it, eventually your body will be crushed itself. Now, the Lam Rim tells us several things about karma. And Geshe is going to do that in the Lam Rim course. Probably great things are going 3 or 4 years from now. But here's what the Lam Rim tells us. The first thing is karma is definite, which means that everything you do, you will get a result. The next thing is karma increases. And that means that after you plant the seed, its potential effect begins to grow. And it keeps on growing until that seed ripens. You know, just like you can get several ears of corn from a single kernel of corn that you plant. The third thing is that you do not experience somebody else's karma. You only experience the ripening of your own karma. The fourth thing is that a good deed or good karma or white karma ripens as a pleasant experience. And that's by definition. The definition of good karma is that which results in a pleasant experience. And then, of course, the next one is a bad deed, or bad karma, we call it, or black karma, ripens as an unpleasant experience. And then neutral deeds ripen as neutral experience, which is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And a good part of what we experience during the day is probably neutral karma, unless you're having a really bad day, or week, or month. And then the last thing in the Lamrim is every experience we have is the result of karmic seeds ripening. So basically, we can say that our lives are determined by the things we've done in the past. If we're living today miserably, it's because we've done bad things in the past. And then, if we want to live happily, we must begin doing good things. Now, only Buddhists can see what particular actions we've done ripen as particular results. No one else can see this. But we have to be able to have some idea of what kinds of actions cause what kinds of results. So Lord Buddha taught us some of these karmic relationships. The most basic ones are given in the Lamrim as the 10 non-virtuous actions. Their opposites, then, are virtuous actions. The relations between causes and results are called correlations, or karmic correlations sometimes. And we have 10 sets in the Lamrim. And there are others in various other sutras and commentaries. The Wheel of Knives itself has 25 to 30 correlations like this. Some of the cause-effect relationships are rather obvious. Like, if you kill somebody, you yourself will be killed. And other ones are not so obvious. You know, like idle chatter results in bad crops. So you know the 10 non-virtues. There are 3 non-virtues of body, which are killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct. There are 4 of speech, which are lying, divisive speech, harsh speech, and idle chatter. And then there are 3 of mind, which are covetousness, harmful intent, and wrong view. Now, according to Scripture, there are 84,000 wrong things that we can do. Now, the 10 non-virtues can be thought of as the top 10, or maybe as 10 categories of the 84,000. But the most important point that we have to keep in mind about karma is that whatever we experience comes from us. The boss yelling at us actually comes from us. Enjoying a piece of chocolate cake comes from us. A failed relationship is only our fault. You know, enlightenment is granted by us, to us, and not by anybody else. Now, there are actually 4 possible results that come from a single action. And Jeetsong Kapa did a rough correlation of the results of karma. This is in his Lamrim. You know, for example, sexual misconduct results in, first of all, the habit of engaging in more and more sexual misconduct because you begin to enjoy it. And second of all, it results in a propelling result or propelling karma, which has to do with the next the form that we take in our next life, we call a class a month ago. And the propelling result of sexual misconduct is being born in a lower realm. The ripening result, which is the third kind of result, is not being able to keep a partner, you know, because you've taken somebody else's partner away. And then finally, the environmental result is living in an unpleasant place, you know, where there's lots of pollution, where it's really dirty or filthy, you know, lots of bad smells, things like that. And Jeetsong Khapa doesn't go into any more detail than that. But the Wheel of Knives does. Ah, one more thing. When a karmic seed ripens, it leaves behind some small trace of itself. It's like a smell or something. If mostly bad seeds are ripening for you, it's like a salad bowl which has been rubbed with lots of garlic. You know, the garlic smell is overpowering. If a good seed ripens, like having the smell of a rose, you don't notice it so much because of the smell of the garlic. And the same is true for the opposite situation. Now, we want to change our smell, as it were, from garlic to roses. Now, at first, not much happens, but eventually we begin to smell rose rather than garlic. The traces of the ripening karmic seeds we leave behind are usually referred to as imprints. These traces themselves, they aren't seeds. They don't ripen into results, but they do influence the total effect of the seeds that do ripen, just as the example of garlic and roses. So, back to the Wheel of Knives. There are many examples that reflect the fact that it is we who are responsible for the things that happen to us. For example, there's a phrase, shooting yourself in the foot, or what goes around comes around, or we are our own worst enemy. And then there are two toward the end of the first half of the text. One of them is the example of a blacksmith who accidentally kills himself with a sword he's forging for somebody else. Like he trips, he's carrying the sword and trips and he falls on it and kills himself. And the second example is an archer who falls on his own arrow. So the author, Dharmarakshita, begins the text by bowing down to the three jewels, which is a typical way to start a text. And then he changes his mind, and he bows down to the Lord of Death, you know, Yamantaka. And we'll see why later in the text. Now, the first verse of the text, and the first verse is on page, what? Well, it's the second page. It's page 48, where it says, peacocks wander in the midst of the forest of poisonous trees. This first verse mentions peacocks. In Tibet, the common wisdom is that peacocks thrive on poison. Now, they would much rather drink a bottle of arsenic than have a nice creme brulee. It's thought that the beauty of all their tail feathers comes from these poisons. The poisons not only don't hurt them, the peacocks thrive on them. And then the second verse explains the first verse. Peacocks refer to bodhisattvas who thrive on poison, and the poison is their own and others' mental afflictions. Bodhisattvas transform their mental afflictions into virtues. Or another way to put that is, bodhisattvas transform mental afflictions into the path. Bodhisattvas are warriors, you know. They thrive on pain. They don't like nice, pretty, comfortable things. You know, think of the Spartan soldiers in the movie 300, which you may have seen. You know, every time in that movie that you heard them say, "We are Spartans," you know, change it to, "We are bodhisattvas," you know, then you've got the idea. Now, there's a common misconception that's going around about this second verse. That misconception is that bodhisattvas would rather remain in the desire realm, waiting until all other people are enlightened, and then seek enlightenment themselves. Now, this is actually breaking a bodhisattva vow. If you have bodhisattva vows, you have a vow to reach enlightenment as quickly as possible. You've made that promise when you took the bodhisattva vows. And any time you don't do that, or any time you have the thought that you shouldn't get enlightened as quickly as possible, you're breaking that vow. So bodhisattvas do want to get enlightened as quickly as possible so that they can really begin to help other beings by showing them how to get enlightened. They really don't know how to get enlightened until they themselves have done it, you know. And then they can show other people how to do it. In addition, you know, when you're enlightened, you emanate millions of bodies on different planets, you know, to help a million people or millions of people. So what this verse means, this verse 2, is that bodhisattvas use adversity to practice, and they do it gladly. They don't back away from the edge of enlightenment at all. They don't seek out bad situations rather than work towards enlightenment. If bad situations happen to come along, they use that as a spiritual practice, but they don't deliberately seek them out. You know, the fourth chapter of Abhidharmakosha opens with Lili Jitta Natsokhe, which you've heard hundreds of times too, which means that everything that happens to you comes from what you do. If you do bad things or seek out bad situations, you suffer for it, and you're slowed down from reaching enlightenment. So a bodhisattva never does bad things, and they never seek out bad situations. Now, at Diamond Mountain, you know, Geshe-la has taught us to distinguish between the instrument and the cause, or, you know, what we call the how and the why. The how we suffer at some moment is our boss yelling at us. The why is that we yelled at somebody else beforehand. You know, the wheel of knives then has brought this yelling back to us. We yelled at somebody. We sent that wheel of knives out. It goes out circling and comes back and it cuts us as somebody yelling at us. So, verse 3. This is where we find that the world works opposite from the way that we think it does. You know, people who seek their own happiness get only pain for that. And those who are willing to take on the pain of others find only happiness. And then in verse 4, the point is made again, you know, that bodhisattva warriors are like peacocks who thrive on poisons. You know, they thrive on mental afflictions, their own and others. Crows, on the other hand, cannot eat the poisonous plants, and they must eat herbs and sweet plants. You know, crows, the opposite of peacocks, are self-cherishing. They're the opposite of bodhisattvas. Those who think only of themselves can never summon the courage to deal with their own and others' pain, and thus they can never gain enlightenment. Then in verse 5, it tells us that those on the lower path, you know, the crows, who cannot handle the poison of their mental afflictions, are in great danger of not being able to even reach nirvana. Bodhisattvas, on the other hand, take their mental afflictions and they turn them into sustenance for use in traveling the path to enlightenment. So bodhisattvas deal with their mental afflictions, and dealing with them destroys them. And at the same time, it turns them into ways to succeed on the bodhisattva path. Then verse 6 talks about how grasping to this sense of a separate, self-sustaining, substantial self is what keeps us in the vicious cycle of rebirth, you know, where we spend most of our time in unthinking suffering in the three lower realms. And to counter this, we must run far from our desire, you know, to do only what's good for us, to do only what feels good, and instead take on all kinds of hardships for others' sake. Again, we don't seek those out, but when they occur, we take them on. And we take them on for the benefit of other people. Verse 7 shows us a little bit about how we use our mental afflictions as part of the path. First of all, we think that everyone else is just like us, you know, in that they are forced by their karma into continuous rebirths, and that their minds are filled with mental afflictions, just as ours are. And then it shows us that if we willingly take their pain into us, we can throw it down upon the head of the part of us that thinks only about us and smash that tendency that we have. And this describes the practice of Tonglen. And then verse 8 continues by saying that whenever we realize that we're thinking just about ourselves, that we should stop and give away whatever happiness we're experiencing at that moment to others. We should do this especially when our friends appear to turn against us. You know, we must think that the reason for this happiness is that we haven't the reason for the unhappiness is that we haven't kept our minds on doing kind things in the past. You know, that we've instead ignored or harmed our friends. When we do this, we gain instead an insight into why we are experiencing friends turning on us, you know. And this in turn gives us a sort of calm. By turning this way of thinking around, we make progress in stamping out our self-cherishing thoughts. So these first 8 verses put us into a frame of mind where we're ready to start listening to the teachings about specific kinds of karma, which start in the next verse. So we're, what, in verse 9, I think. I'm not going to read all of these, but verse 9 says, whenever my body is stricken by some unbearable sickness, it's because the wheel of knives has turned on me again, the karma of doing harm to the bodies of other people. From now on, then, I'll take upon my own body all the sickness that comes to anyone at all. So, you know, this gives us the karmic correlation. We get sick. And this is about really, really sick. And that's because we've done harm to the bodies of other people. And then the antidote is, you know, from now on, I'll take upon my own body all the sickness that comes to anyone at all. Now, we do that in Tonglen. We, in fact, cannot take somebody's sickness away from them. But we can use Tonglen to take their pain, to diminish our own self-cherishing. So this goes on for, I don't know, 25 verses. It continues up through verse 36. I don't know if these verses aren't numbered in your text, so you're going to have to number them yourself. But verse 36, when my want for things is great. I'll find it here somewhere. It's on page 62. And then on the next verse, when I look ugly to others, and those around me insult me for it, it's because the wheel of knives has turned on me again. The karma of making holy images without taking the proper care, and of letting anger drive me into a state of turmoil. From now on, then, I'll craft these holy images right and learn to endure with patience. And this is where we're beginning to meet the enemy. These verses up through verse 47 are beginning to show us our self-cherishing, which is our enemy. So since this is a Lojong text, whenever Dharma Rakshita points out a karmic result, something painful we're encountering, he then tells us what to do with. He tells us why it's happening, and then tells us what to do instead. So the what to do instead is doing the opposite from what we normally do, and by doing the opposite, it diminishes our self-cherishing. And if we keep on doing this, we're beginning to batter the self-cherishing over the head until eventually it gets very weak, and we're not self-cherishing people anymore. And this is how we do it. This is the mind training. You know, this text is talking about yelling bosses, you know, and friends who hurt us, and how we are not able to find and keep partners, you know, things like that. It talks about severe headaches. It talks about depression. It talks about not having enough money or people around us who can't seem to get along. And we found out, you know, that every bad thing that happens to us was caused by something we ourselves had done earlier. So this nice little Lojong text, you know, it starts off with the author bowing to the three jewels, which is our refuge, and then he bows down to the fiery angel, you know, the Lord of Death, or the Lord over Death, that tantric deity. And why does he bow down to the tantric deity? In this text, we're being taught both karma and emptiness, mainly karma, but also emptiness by extension. You know, whenever somebody teaches you emptiness, they must also teach you karma. Whenever somebody teaches you karma, they must also teach you emptiness. One of them doesn't work without the other. You can evaluate teachers, you know, you can evaluate teachers you go to by seeing if they do that. And if they don't, you probably can't trust what they say about emptiness or karma because they don't get the connection. Any teacher who understands karma and emptiness and how they're related, how they cannot be separated, whenever they talk about karma, they will talk about emptiness. Whenever they talk about emptiness, they will talk about karma. You know, at the end of the karma class, course 5, Geshe-la spends about half an hour talking about emptiness. And also at the end, or at some point in the Diamond Cutter, which is talking about emptiness, he talks about karma as well. So a teacher always has to do that. So bad things happen to us. You know, the boss yells at us. It seems that the boss is actually a yelling boss. You know, he is yelling independent of us. He's yelling independent of what we feel, you know, or what we see. But we have been looking at reasons why the yelling boss can't be a yelling boss independent of us, you know. If he were, then everyone hearing him would be hurt or offended. You know, but there's that guy two cubicles over who's thinking, yeah, it's about time he got what was coming to him. You know, those two independent perceptions are possible only if the yelling boss is not a yelling boss or an avenging angel from his own side. And that's emptiness. The boss does not have a nature of either yelling or avenging angel that comes from him, independent of anything else. Then how is it that I see the boss as yelling at me, you know, as hurting me? And this other guy is overjoyed that I am being put down. You know, it can only be the case that there's something about us that causes us to see him in the way that each of us see him. And that's karma. Something we have done in the past is the cause for me seeing him as yelling and being hurt because of it. And the other guy seeing him as dishing out punishment that I so rightly deserve, you know, is glad because of karma. Karma only works because things have no nature of their own. They're empty of having any nature of their own. And because things have no nature of their own, they do not exist from their own side. But yet they do exist. It must be that they exist in dependence on other things, then. The yelling boss exists in dependence upon my past actions. The avenging angel exists independent on my office mate's past actions. And this is no contradiction. You know, the two different bosses are perceived based on the same object. In this case, a male human. The only thing to realize, it's one thing to realize this at an intellectual level while in class or on your cushion or while discussing it with somebody else over coffee. But it's quite another thing to remember this when your boss is yelling at you or your boyfriend is packing up and walking out on your relationship. But if we can manage to not get angry, you know, when the boss yells at us, understanding that the yelling is actually produced by our karma, it's that wheel coming back to us, you know, then we can begin to break this cycle of constant suffering. Even if you can do it for just a second, then a few times later, it will be 2 seconds, and then 5 seconds, and eventually you'll be able to stand there thinking to yourself, boy, it was really stupid of me to cause this. He looks kind of ridiculous, doesn't he? You know, and then a little later it becomes, oh, he must really be suffering now. How sad. He's been my mother and loved me, and I have to make him into this monster. That's my fault. Understanding karma and emptiness in this way is all you need to get to nirvana. You know, nothing more. So the first half of this Lojong text, The Wheel of Knives, is training us to see that what happens to us is caused by us. If we have headaches, it's probably due to breaking promises that we have made to our teachers or parents, you know, maybe. If people yell at us all the time, that's because we yelled at others in the past. Does that also mean that we yell at people in this life too? Well, not necessarily. You know, you may be a quiet, modest, respectful person now, you know, who never yells at anybody, but you get yelled at all the time anyway. So how do you then get people to stop yelling at you? I mean, if you're not yelling at people, and how do you get them to stop yelling at you? I mean, there's nothing to stop. It's like you're in a sinking ship and there's nothing left to throw overboard. You're just going to sink. It's kind of like that, you know. So since you don't yell now and you can't stop yelling at people, which is the obvious antidote to avoid yelling at people in your life, how do you fix it? And here is where you have to be much more careful than other people to make sure that you don't say any unkind thing about other people or to other people, even in jest. These kind of subtle fixes are things we have to become very aware of. The Wheel of Knives in the first half tells us the problems we may be having and what has caused them. And then it tells us what we do in order to not have these problems in the future. You know, and that's how we stop our suffering. So if it turns out we're having problems and we look at the antidote and there's really no antidote to apply, like we don't yell at people, so stopping yelling, you know, isn't going to help us any, what do we do? And we have to just be very, very careful in everything we do regarding the probable cause of what's happening to us. I remember, I think it was in the Karma class, Geshe-la told the story of a woman who came up to him after one of the classes. And she was having a problem that she couldn't really get her finger on. She didn't understand the cause. And they talked for it a while. And Geshe-la said, well, the cause has to be some sort of sexual misconduct. And has there been? And she said, well, yeah, in the first year of marriage, this is 20 years ago, I was unfaithful to my husband once, you know. But we got through that, and everything's been fine since. I've been very, very careful about that. And he said, okay, so now you have to be super careful. When you're walking down the street, for example, and you see maybe a picture on a magazine cover of a handsome young man, look away. You know, don't allow yourself to be attracted to that. Just look away. Be very, very careful in what you're doing. Very, very subtle. Don't allow any small thought of desire for somebody other than your husband enter your mind. And that's the kind of thing we have to do. And now, in the text, we get to a break. Up to this point, the author, meaning us, has been complaining about the things that happened to us and why they happen. Verse after verse after verse, he's identified the problem and saying, that I'm not going to do that anymore. And in the text, you get the feeling that the author, meaning us, you know, is getting kind of uptight. And now we get mad. We're beginning to figure out the root cause of why all this keeps happening to us. We already know that we get headaches because we broke our promises. And we know that we get yelled at because we yelled at others. But what's the root cause, the real cause of all of this, you know? What made us do those things? And now we really get mad, you know? We figured it out. And we take on the aspect of Yamantaka, you know, this tantric deity, and we let loose with rage. And we're going to cover that in the next class. For now, though, turn to page 6 to 8 of your reading. The next several pages here are a supplement to reading 8. They go through all the karmic correlations that the text has presented up to now. You know, for example, let's go down to page 69, first one at the top. You suffer in the service of another whose authority is more, like you got a really horrible supervisor. The cause is arrogance toward those who are less than you. You know, it's forcing others to do your own work. And the antidote, then, is forcing your own body and life into the service of others. That's how we get rid of it. So we have these this chart of karmic correlations. And one of the homework questions, which is a long one, is going to give you a list of things, problems you may be experiencing, and then you're supposed to match that up with what you do to get rid of it. Or is it the cause? I forget. You'll figure it out in the homework. What else do I have to cover? I think that's it.